Support for the California Report comes from the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On this week before Thanksgiving, we've got a smorgasbord of food stories for you, including a cooking class for former inmates. Step one, realizing just how bad prison food was. Also, tips on carving the bird from a professional knife sharpener and harvesting an exotic version of quinoa on the side of the road in Los Angeles.
This is really a species that evolved in disturbance. It's really well adapted to people. It's like the cockroach of the plant world.
All that plus dessert, mocha cappuccino mochi.
Steaming it, the timing. You have to really know how to time it and then work your way around the machinery since it's all old from the 1900s.
It's the California Report. Thanksgiving is the holiday that's all about the food, and so today we've got a full menu of culinary tales as well. And we begin with a cooking class for a group of folks who haven't had the chance to do much cooking in a very, very long time. The California Report's health reporter April Demboski paid a visit to a class where former inmates are learning their way around the kitchen.
The chef has thrown down the challenge.
Right nearby. Yeah.
Come up with your own version of veggie chili. There are five teams, 10 people each. Juanita Alvarado stirs the secret ingredient into the pot for team one. They call themselves the Super Hots. This simmering pot of fresh black beans, zucchini, and carrots is a far cry from what Alvarado ate when she was in prison. Late nights in the bunks, inmates would pool their goods from the commissary to make a prison concoction called the spread.
It's a ramen noodle, and it consists of pickle juice, tuna, Velveeta cheese, sausages, pork rinds, mayonnaise.
Then they mix it all together and cook it, so to speak.
It's basically getting a plastic bag and asking for hot water and smashing everything and keeping it steamed for like an hour and putting it in a tortilla. It's actually really tasty, but it really hurts your stomach.
And it's really bad for you. Alvarado says she gained 70 pounds eating like this in prison.
You get out and you think, oh, you know, I'm okay, I'm healthy, I'm big, I'm good. But you don't realize your body's really damaged inside.
Today, Alvarado works at the Transitions Health Clinic in San Francisco, helping people recently out of prison manage conditions like diabetes and hypertension. Community health workers like Alvarado have all done time. They call on their own experiences to mentor patients through finding a job, housing, and food. About 50 community health workers from clinics across the country gathered in San Francisco recently for this cooking class. Alvarado says it's kind of a train the trainers on how to shop for healthy food.
And also to be able to learn how to cook and cook with a budget so that they're not just going back to ramen noodles and spreads.
Yeah, no more spreads. The thing is, that's really hard for a lot of people coming out of prison. California is one of 34 states that ban people convicted of certain drug crimes from receiving food stamps. 90% of the patients at the Transitions Clinic skip meals or struggle to get enough food, in part because of the ban. Clinic director Dr. Shira Shavit says their health suffers.
We know when people don't have access to healthy food that they're at risk for chronic conditions, or their chronic conditions get worse, or they're at risk, you know, for HIV.
Like one patient from the clinic.
She had to work as a sex worker to be able to buy a Happy Meal for her children to feed them.
Studies show that steady access to food reduces crime and recidivism. That's why California lawmakers decided to get rid of the food stamps ban starting this spring. Health clinics want to be ready.
When you're at the store and you're trying to make a decision about what to buy,
Chef Holly Green has been teaching cooking on a budget to low-income and homeless populations for years.
Whole chickens are about a dollar less per pound than when you start to buy all the different parts.
Chef Holly also has gentle strategies for encouraging people to buy more fruits and vegetables, or brown rice instead of white rice, or even quinoa.
You know what I call it?
What is it?
Well, when I was growing up, I thought it was for people that hug trees, because I used to call it quinoa, and everybody did.
Quinoa.
Right? So I call it keen.
At the end of the night, Chef Holly goes around sampling each pot of chili. She dips a spoon into the bowl from Juanita Alvarado's team, the Super Hots.
That's fantastic. I feel like I'm on a cruise ship.
Chef Holly says it's the best chili she's ever had. For the California Report, I'm April Dymbosky.
Those former inmates will have to wait until next April to be eligible for food stamps and other public benefits. Until then, what do you do when you get out of prison with no money and nothing to eat? As part of our health series, Vital Signs, we hear from Aus Jarrar. He was released from prison after an 11-year sentence just weeks ago. Without food stamps, he's one charity meal away from hunger. We caught up with him as he rushed around downtown Oakland looking for food.
They started already. We might not have enough food left. So I'm hoping that we're not too late. I don't know, we have to cross the street. And there's another guy just came in front of us. So, oh, we got enough. There's enough food today. There's enough bags. And they're giving cereal.
This is great, man. I got some vegetables. I got some fruits.
Now we could actually relax, but I'm already used to walking fast. The prison system, they give us $200 to leave with. I had no clothes, and I have no food. So I had to make the choice between, do I want to look professional so I could get a job, or do I want to eat in prison? I got certified as a drug and alcohol counselor. This is the career I'm pursuing. So I can't look the way my clients look. I'm interning, you know, I don't want to call it a job because I'm not getting paid. And now I'm heading home. I'm on 37th and my home is on 37th. So I got a couple of blocks. And pick up the stuff. Mi casa si cuesta. Close the door. The eggplant we got from the place today. You know, if I could just eat the potatoes hard and raw, and then that's going to taste like crap. But if wait, cook it, and wait till the seasoning sets in and it's ready, then it'll taste good compared to my life, you know. I'm out here, and this is what I really want to do. So if I struggle a little bit right now volunteering and doing some internship hours, it'll pay off in the long run.
That story was reported by Jeremy Raff. He spoke with Aus Jarrar, who was just released after 11 years in prison and is trying to feed himself with no food stamps. Find photos of Aus in his halfway house online at californiareport.org. Those of us who are lucky enough to have the option of indulging this Thanksgiving will eat and eat and eat some more, and then sit around a lot. As this perfect storm of calories approaches, we bring you this story, a favorite from last year, from the California Report's Rachel Miro. She found a class in Marin County that teaches mindful eating, urging us to slow down and put down our knife and fork.
This story starts with a phenomenon we're all familiar with. And I'll tell you, it happens a lot at work. Somebody drops a box of donuts on the table right next to my cubicle. Smell warm sugar and fat. And suddenly, I'm Homer Simpson.
Donuts.
Hey, Homer, slow down. You're going to choke or something.
Don't tell me how to eat donuts.
The only thing that stops me from eating more than 2 donuts is the fear of shame and self-disgust, although that doesn't always stop me. But as a child of the 70s, I know the places where we struggle most offer the richest opportunities for spiritual growth.
Welcome.
I'm at a day-long retreat led by a group that includes a Buddhist nun and a psychologist and the lead teacher who specializes in mindful eating, Andrea Lieberstein.
So eating is a wonderful tool to awaken and to remember who we are and to remember our connection with all of life.
That's not what I use eating for. I use it to feel relief from hunger. I use it to bury boredom and stave off exhaustion. I use it because it's readily available and legal.
We are hardwired to have many, many triggers to eat just to make sure we're getting enough calories to survive.
Alyssa Eppel is a health psychology researcher at UCSF.
The pleasure center in the brain is one of the most powerful motivators of human behavior. We do things to stimulate that center and get dopamine. And that includes sex, drugs, love, highly palatable food.
Many of the people in today's class are here in a professional capacity to learn how to help clients who struggle with food issues. But just about everybody is also personally interested in bringing more consciousness to the practice of eating. Monica Brown is a marriage and family therapist from Oakland.
I sometimes think I eat like a dog. Like a Labrador retriever, it's hard not to gulp my food. So it takes a lot of mindfulness to slow down the eating and take a bite at a time, put the fork down. We all have good intentions, but when we're stressed out, it's hard to remember that.
This is where Buddhist meditation helps to refocus the mind. The Venerable Jampa Sagmo is a Tibetan Buddhist nun in the Gelupa tradition, the same one followed by the Dalai Lama.
Every time you think of that donut, just think, oh, this is my reminder to be aware of the present moment and not necessarily eating the donut.
But how does focusing on the present moment help me fight my hard wiring? Lieberstein has the class conduct an experiment. Attendants pass out Dove chocolate squares.
Looking at the color, the shape, the texture.
We draw out the moment as long as possible, until every cell in our bodies is focused on the promise of chocolate.
And then slowly begin to bite into it, noticing the flavor, the taste of that first bite.
It's like a nuclear explosion, the most satisfying experience imaginable, rich, silky, just like the commercial promises.
The moments you love, you want to experience over and over again.
And then we're invited to have a second square. It's the same chocolate, but the intensity of the satisfaction is weaker. If you're really paying attention as you eat, you enjoy it more. Your brain registers when you've had enough. You don't need the second chocolate square or donut. For the California Report, I'm Rachel Miro in Marin.
For most folks, turkey, not donuts, is the star of the Thanksgiving table. And just before we dig in, someone will be designated carver-in-chief. And these days, many amateur chefs are getting their knives sharpened, so serving up that bird for Thanksgiving dinner comes off without a hitch. Earlier this week, we paid a visit to someone who learned a thing or two about the importance of a good sharp knife as an artist.
I'm sharpening a santoku here, a Japanese knife. To start with, I'm going to remove a moderate amount of metal to get the edge reestablished. And here I'm on a medium grit whetstone. My name is Josh Donald, and we're in Bernal Cutlery in San Francisco, California. We do Japanese whetstone sharpening, and we sell kitchen knives. I got into sharpening through sculpture, through carving, mostly wood carving, and that's where I discovered Japanese tools. I started this business. I was laid off from a job, and my wife was working freelance, and we had a 9-month-old baby at home. We were trying to think of ways to drum up grocery money or pay a bill or two, and I was sharpening our kitchen knives, and my wife Kelly and I, we thought, hey, you know what? I like doing this. Why don't we put up some flyers and see what happens? a real busy day where we're really just, you know, very focused on sharpening, it might be about 30 to 50 knives in a day. We have customers coming in and out. We have orders being dropped off.
All right, dropping off sharpening.
I talked to you yesterday, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
I have 25 people coming over, so it's very needed.
Cool. Thanks, Susan.
All right.
See you.
Bye.
The fineness of the polishing stone that we use at the end, that really gives it its cutting characteristics. So Thanksgiving, people find themselves in front of a turkey and with a knife in their hand. And a couple of tips that we would have would be, if you want to get real thin slices from the breast, use a slicer, a long, long narrow knife. Make sure it's longer than the breast meat that you're going to be carving. And don't assault the bones, the joints, with that same knife. If you are okay with larger slices, then use a chef's knife. That's okay. Probably what we do here is, you know, at its essence, not changed a whole lot for centuries.
Josh Donald owns Bernal Cutlery in San Francisco's Mission District. Some Thanksgiving tables will surely include quinoa, the protein-packed grain that's becoming a staple on restaurant menus. You can find the dried version at most grocery stores these days, but in Los Angeles, you can also find it on the side of the road. Wild quinoa grows all over L.A. It's actually thriving despite the drought. Reporter Casey Miner introduces us to a scientist who thinks this roadside weed could help feed the world.
Rick Jelen and I are standing on the side of a windy two-lane road in Los Angeles, not far from Mulholland Drive. There's trash on the ground, a sad-looking political sign stuck in some dry leaves, and uninterrupted traffic.
Yeah, it's not like a pristine habitat or anything.
But it's ideal for what we're trying to find, a plant called pitseed goosefoot, also known as wild quinoa. It's growing all around us, just a foot or two from the pavement. Thin stalks about shin height with purplish-gray seeds.
People have just, they don't recognize this as a genetic resource. They recognize it as a weed.
Jelen's a little obsessed with this weed.
I'm a geneticist. I'm a plant geneticist.
He's based at Brigham Young University in Utah. And when he spots wild quinoa on the side of the road, he beelines for it.
It's kind of a joke with my wife and kids.
Jelen's a plant guy, so he might be this fascinated no matter what. But we should pay attention, too. As the climate shifts and growing conditions change, the hunt is on for foods that can survive challenges like extreme heat and prolonged drought. Jelen thinks wild quinoa is one of those foods. Grocery store quinoa is mainly farmed in the Andes in South America. It's adapted to that climate. But wild quinoa grows all over the place, in all kinds of conditions. Take L.A. The city's in its fourth year of drought, and for Jelen, it's a real-life laboratory. Right now, the wild quinoa experiment looks like a success.
This is really a species that evolved in disturbance. It's really well adapted to people, okay? It's like the cockroach of the plant world.
There are teams of scientists around the world collecting the wild relatives of many common crops, not just quinoa. These plants contain genetic secrets that could help all our food. But it's a long way from the side of the road to your dinner table. Plant breeding can take decades, and in the meantime, someone has to keep an eye on the samples we have and make sure they stay alive. That's where Roger Chatelet comes in.
We're going to turn the exhaust fans off, which means it's going to get warm.
Chatelet directs the Tomato Genetics Resource Center at UC Davis, the country's biggest store of tomato wild relatives. We're in a big, warm greenhouse that smells a little like pasta sauce. There are hundreds of rows of plants.
So would I recognize this as a tomato if you just put it down in front of me?
No, you probably wouldn't. Most people wouldn't. The fruit are about the size of a pea, about the color of a pea, too. They're green, and they never turn red. They slowly dehydrate. And then they become like an eggshell, so a brown little eggshell type of texture.
Chatelet's mentor was the scientist Charles Rick, who collected a lot of the tomatoes in here from places where you'd never imagine a tomato growing. The one we're looking at now is called Solanum lycopersicoides, the Peruvian wolf peach. It's a very distant relative of the cultivated tomato.
This would be like, you know, a distant cousin, once removed sort of thing.
That one's called Solanum jugulandifolium. It only grows in wet, dark jungle.
Then there are other species that are at the other end of the spectrum. They grow in very flooded environments, and we'll just go over here and look at one of them.
Châtelet's challenge is to keep these two very different plants happy in the same greenhouse, while making sure they grow as close as possible to the way they would in the wild. This means taking some things out of nature's hands.
You can see that this species likes the shade and the moisture because the stems are just literally crowding the cooling pads over there like they can't get enough moisture and shade. We've eliminated bees in our greenhouse.
Usually, bees flying around and pollinating plants is a good thing. But in this greenhouse, it would wreak havoc. So
we tried to reproduce what bees are doing by artificially buzzing the flowers with an electric bee. But, you know, it's not exactly the same.
Did you say an electric bee?
Yeah, we have an electric bee. It's not what you think. It's not like a little drone. It's a vibrator. We can take a look at it.
This is the amount of control we're talking about here. And it matters, because how we eat in the future could depend on how well we understand the way these plants handle extremes.
Having access to genetic sources of traits like disease resistance, increased yield, improved nutritional value of fruits, those are all traits that really directly relevant to consumers, I think.
It's up to scientists like Roger Châtelet and Rick Jelen to find those traits, to unlock the secrets of the wild plants. When they do, we may all look a little differently at the weeds on the side of the road. For the California Report, I'm Casey Miner.
And finally today, the best part of the meal, talking about dessert, of course. One tradition for many Japanese Americans is to bring manju, or Japanese pastries, to family gatherings. But making the pastry is considered a dying art. The one and only manju bakery in the San Joaquin Valley draws customers from all over the state. It's in Fresno's Chinatown, and as Alice Daniel reports, it's been run by the same family for nearly a century.
Lynn Ketta points to an old black and white photograph that hangs on the wall of her family's store called Kogetsu Do.
Those are my grandparents on my dad's side. They started in 1915 on Kern Street, and then 1920 they moved over to F, which is here now, 920 F Street.
The shop hasn't changed much. Ikeda still uses the rice pounder her grandparents did, the same glass display cases, even the beautiful wooden boxes that hold tidy rows of wrapped pastries, some made with steamed cake flour. Tiny imprints of cranes and flowers grace the tops.
And these right here are done with a branding iron. I just brought some out for you. These are all imported from Japan, and these are really hard to find. Like, this is a picture of a rose that's there. Oops.
Hello.
Customer.
Hello.
Dan and Judy Morinaga have been coming here for 40 years. They knew Ikeda's father back when he ran the business.
So what are you going to order?
I have one dozen.
They're planning for Thanksgiving, and a box of manju is on the menu.
You already have the breakdown, huh, in your book?
Yes.
Okay.
A dozen mochi, a sweet rice flour dough wrapped around fruit or bean paste, to take to Dan's parents. But why stop there?
Oh, you know what? Let me take another dozen because my sister from the Bay Area will be here.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah.
And then Judy gets something for herself, mochi filled with ice cream. There's Butterfinger, cherry, strawberry.
Chocolate with almond toffee.
Ooh.
Is mocha almond fudge.
Oh.
Raspberry sorbet.
It's an agonizing decision.
What do I want to eat? Let's see.
Finally, mocha cappuccino. Ikeda begins each day long before her customers arrive. She cooks rice flour in a steamer with sugar and water and works the dough on a granite counter. She won't let me or anyone in the kitchen. Her father gave her the dough recipe he got from his father, and she's kept it a secret.
They spent a lot of years perfecting it, and I like to keep it that way.
The bakery has been open for a century, but during World War II, the family was forced into an internment camp in Arkansas. Ikeda's grandfather rented out the store to a Chinese family he knew, but even at the internment camp, he found a way to bake.
Someone told me that my grandfather was baking the Japanese pastries out there. He would make sure there was no one in the kitchen, first off.
The family returned to a bustling Chinatown after World War II, but over the past few decades, the district has emptied out. Now people like Kathy Omachi are trying to revitalize the area by giving tours of places like Kogetsu Do.
And that you can't really get from books or photos or other things, because it's that real touch of the living, of what it means to have that kind of history just in your own backyard. It's a treasure.
Omachi's dad was born here in China Alley, just behind Kogetsu Do. She says the bakery made immigrants feel more at home.
How about the boysenberry? Are these white bean or black bean, the pink ones?
The pink ones, white bean.
Lynn Ikeda's 21-year-old daughter, Emmy, sometimes helps customers at the shop. She's the bakery's only successor, but she doesn't plan on taking it over, so its long-term future is up in the air. Still, she says, she respects the craft.
Just getting all the right ingredients in it, steaming it, the timing. You have to really know how to time it and then work your way around the machinery since it's all old from the 1900s.
She says when she's here, she feels like she's traveling back in time. Just one of many reasons customers keep returning to Kogetsu Do. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
Not since those bygone days of old June, I have a person had to look out of mine. Seems that I was born just a star.
We always want to hear what you think of the California Report. If you have questions or story ideas, send them to calreport@kqed.org. That's calreport@kqed.org. And be sure to check out our spiffy new home at californiareport.org. That is the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. Technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer, Howard Gelman, and Jim Bennett. The online team includes David Weir, Lisa Pickoff White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Adisa Egan and Isaac Silk. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malione, Polly Stryker, Kat Snow, Julia McAvoy, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and a happy Thanksgiving. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children.